Spirit Radio Podcasts.
What jobs have you been doing during lockdown? Are there household jobs you're still putting off, such as sitting down with your finances and making financial projections? Well, it's certainly a good time to do it, because particularly as for many, there has been some financial uncertainty in the last few months that could also lead into the summer. On the line to tell us more, we have John Lowe of Money Doctors, who give independent financial advice. You're very welcome back to the show, John. How are you?
Good morning, Roland, and hope you're all safe and well in there.
Yeah, absolutely, and same to yourself, John. First of all, John, for many around the country, their finances might not be looking quite the same as they did this time last year due to some workplaces being closed during lockdown, some parents having to reduce their work hours, people having to take reduced salaries. What is your advice to those individuals and families?
Well, there's an awful lot of things happening. First of all, we're not spending as much money as we used to spend, which is a good thing.
That's true.
You know, our credit cards are kind of down on, you know, what we're spending. Cash, I can't remember the last time I actually held any cash.
Yeah, exactly.
The last 4 months, which is a good thing as well, because God knows what's on those notes, you know, for picking up little bugs. And then you've got all the other things like tourism, unfortunately, is down, restaurants, concerts, pubs, transport, childcare, all of these things are way, way down. But this is an absolutely brilliant time to actually review your finances and see, you know, when we do get back, and please God we will, back to normality, maybe in a few months' time, you know, those costs are going to start coming back in again. So now just do a budget and plan. Plan exactly how much does it cost you to run your house on a household basis, on a monthly basis. And that's essentially the kernel of everything, because once you have established how much it does cost you, then you should have, hopefully, they've got a surplus, and that surplus is what you plan with. So, you know, I don't need to tell the kind of listeners that, you know, if they're putting a, one of their children through third level, it's going to cost them 42,000. And even if they put, and they were able to put their state benefit, child benefit away every month from the time the child was born, of €140, it would still, when it stops at the 18th birthday, accumulate only to 28,560.
So it doesn't get close.
14,000 shy of what you need to put them through third level.
Absolutely.
So planning is where it's at. And this is, as I say, a wonderful time to look at your financial plans. So you've got, as I say, the budget. You find out how much money is coming in. And really, you know, Roland, it's a question of once you've done that and you've got your expenditure and your income on either side, and you find that your expenditure is exceeding that income, then you've got three choices. You've got either to earn more, you've got to cut costs, or else you have to prioritize. That's probably why, maybe over the last 5 years, people have dropped their health insurance, by 300,000 of them.
Wow. Never knew that.
Yeah.
So it
is a question of and actually, if you or any of the listeners want to avail of a free budget planner spreadsheet, you can email me. I'd be delighted to send you one.
What do we email?
And that's the start of it.
Where do we email?
JLo, not to be confused with Jennifer Lopez. JLo, JLOWE, at moneydoctors.ie.
Brilliant. Great.
And again, as I say, it's a very, very useful tool to start the ball rolling. And so that you all the categories are there, it tops itself up, and it's really, really simple, because I'm basically, at the end of the day, simple too. So I have to have something that's really simple to use. And this is really simple to use, but it really will tell you how much you're spending on a monthly basis. There's also a couple of apps that I also recommend. Both of them are free.
Okay.
One of them is a thing called Stocard, Stocard. And again, it's if you are going to your local supermarket, you probably have forgotten to bring the discount tags that are supposed to be with your keyring. So this is an app that you can download for free, and you can put all of them, like your gun stores, Super Value, Tesco, you know, all of those discount tags can be put onto this.
All right,
free
brilliant.
App. Yeah. So that you have your phone with you anyway, and especially if you're doing anything under €50 now, because the contactless amount went from 30 to €50, which is very handy, I thought. So it means you don't have to touch cash or cards or stick cards into machines or anything. Just put your phone over the over this machine.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, the second one is my own one, which is called Mrs. Money Doctors. You can download it from the Play Store or App Store. And what that does, it tracks your spending for, you know, usually 4 or 5 weeks or a month you want to do it, just to see where are you fricking away money. How many people go to, even when it was good to go to an ATM, take money out, and a week later you wouldn't have a breeze where that money's gone.
Yeah.
So now you can track it. You can track, you know, 13 different categories, and at the end of 4 or 5 weeks or a calendar month, you press a button, you get a report, you get your top 5 spends, total amount you spent, and geographically where you've spent every cent.
Wow. That's so really good.
Google Maps facility in it as well.
Brilliant.
So
clever.
These are all useful aids and helps, supports to try and make your money management that little bit better.
So, just so I'm clear, money doctors have their own app on the App Store. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
It's called Money Doctors. It's again, my colour of brand is yellow, so you won't miss it. And it's got Money Doctors on it.
Great, right, I'm just going there now. So really, the first two things you said were make more money, which is not necessarily within everyone's gift. The second thing is basically get thrifty at home, I suppose, is
yes,
kind of what you're saying.
You actually analyse every single item of expenditure, Ronan. So
yeah,
that means you ask yourself two questions. One, do I need it? And number two, is there a better or cheaper alternative?
Yeah.
And that's the issue. I mean, I think Charlie Weston wrote in the Indo today about insurance and the number of people who just when their car insurance or their buildings contents insurance comes in, they just, you know, they pay away. And apparently 7 out of 10 do that. And yet their insurance has generally gone up each year. And yet if they shopped around, they would get, you know, fantastic bargains, and they could even go back to their own insurance company who were willing to actually, you know, drop their you know, fees, their
yes,
prices, because they want to retain the business.
Absolutely, yeah. That's, you know, and it's funny, you're speaking to somebody here who's done it precisely that. I seem to have spent all of my 20s and 30s checking out every single insurance, not just for car but for home as well, and I always did it, and I haven't done it in years. So you're dead right, I'm going to go and do it now. That's absolutely
yeah,
straight out.
But it's everything, it's not just insurance.
Yeah,
it's everything, you know.
I suppose, so yeah, utility bills and everything. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, you can shop around on literally, and even if you have to buy a you know, a washing machine or a fridge, or you have to replace your cooker, I mean, that's the thing that you shop around in. Obviously you don't just go to the nearest electrical store or whatever and buy your first washing machine.
And what about your bank?
Anything,
I was going to say, what about your bank account? I only noticed recently that they can kind of be frittering away bits on you there without you kind of really noticing, you know, a couple of quid here, a couple of quid there, charges here, charges there, you know?
Well, I mean, again, there's huge and a number of websites, ccpc.ie, that's the consumer commission and consumer protection commission, believe it or not, consumer protection commission.
Gotcha, yeah.
It's a mouthful, but it's a former national agency which looks at all the comparisons for credit cards, current accounts, and that's a really useful site to go and see and check out, because there are differences, unfortunately, as there always are, between one service and another service. And you shouldn't, I mean, there's some banks out there who are giving free service or giving free current accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to check them out and see where they are. Same with your credit cards. There might be a number of listeners who have maxed out their credit card, for want of a better word.
Sure.
There are 4 credit card companies who will take your balance and they'll give it to you at 0% interest over 6 to 12 months. The best of them, believe it or not, are On Plus Money.
Wow.
Who do a credit card where you transfer the balance over. Say you've got €1,200 of a bill you just can't get rid of.
Yeah.
Transfer it over to them. You pay $100 a month. There's no interest whatsoever. And at the end of 12 months, you've got
a clean,
you know, debt-free card.
Wow, that's amazing. Just one last thing before I let you go, John. A situation that some first-time buyers might now find themselves in is that they've been granted a mortgage, they've been given their cert, as it were, you know, but now their finances have changed due to the COVID-19 virus. What advice do you have for these couples?
Yeah, this is really difficult, because it's not just affecting their finances and the fact that they may have lost a job but they've been put on short time, but even the valuations, Roland, are now starting to come back, because the banks are getting a little bit nervous that because of COVID-19, some of these house prices. And I know, I mean, I have a client who put a holding deposit on the property and have decided not to go ahead with this. They've got the money back because they think that the price of these properties are going to go down.
Oh, right.
I'm not so sure. Yeah. I'm not so sure. But for sure, anyway, those people who have got difficulties with their employment, that is definitely going to have an impact on them. Because we're back to the same thing. You know, what is the main criterion of lending is that you have the ability to repay. If you can't prove that or you haven't got it any longer, then that lender cannot give you that mortgage. That's the problem.
Yeah, it makes sense. Absolutely. John Lowe of Money Doctors, Independent Financial Advice, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Very pleasure, Owen.
God bless you, man. Thank you. And don't forget, folks, www.independentfinancialadvice.ie is where to go to check all that out. And of course, the Money Doctor app at the App Store. Sounds absolutely fascinating. I'm going to go sort that out now. Spirit. Our next guest is going to share their story of being an addictive eater and how they went from food and binge eating controlling their life to now having a healthy relationship with food. In keeping with Addictive Eaters Anonymous tradition of anonymity at a public level, AEA members request that their real names are not used when giving radio interviews. So on the line to tell us more, we have an anonymous member from Addictive Eaters Anonymous. AEA, you are very, very welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Ronan. Thank you very much for having me on your show this morning. I appreciate it.
First of all, can you share with us a bit about your story and what life was like for you before you joined Addictive Eaters Anonymous?
Yeah, I suppose, Ronan, I was very secretive about my eating. I would eat a certain way in front of my work colleagues or the people I lived with, and a different way on my own. So, for example, I could, on a weekend, come down, have my breakfast, and then just keep going back for more. You know, I'd eat a bowl of cereal, and then I'd just find myself standing in the kitchen with my hand in the cereal box, just going for handful after handful of cereal. And then I'd have some toast, and I might have some more toast and cereal then. So it was like one wasn't enough, one portion wasn't enough. And then if I heard other people coming into the kitchen, I stopped doing what I was doing.
So there was kind of an awareness that even though you mightn't have cottoned on to the idea that this was something out of control, there was something not quite right. You didn't want to be other people to be seeing it.
Absolutely, Ronan. I just had a sense that what I was doing just wasn't right, or I just was conscious that I didn't want other people to cop that I'd eaten this volume of food, because some part of me knew that just wasn't normal. So, for example, when I'd be out in the car, I'd be possibly having a binge on food that I wouldn't do in front of somebody else, because I just wouldn't want people to realise that I wanted all this food and that a normal portion just wasn't enough for me. So very secretive, went great lengths to hide the volume of food that I was eating, and just was quite ashamed about it, but at the same time I couldn't stop what I was doing.
And when you were, you know, say binging in the car or something, would you go, for instance, would you hit the shops, buy your favourite foods, or would you bring stuff with you, and what way did it work?
It could work either way, really. For example, if I was on a journey from the country to the city, I might stop in on a petrol station and think that I was just going to pick up some petrol, but I'd pick up other foods when I was there, and I just binge on them in the car, and then I might, before I got to my destination, I might hide the wrappers or throw the wrappers into a bin somewhere. So, you know, it wouldn't even have been that I was hungry, because the chances are I would have had my breakfast or would have had my lunch, but just couldn't not have these other foods. And often the foods were, you know, the chocolate or the buns or the biscuits. But even times where I said to myself I wasn't going to eat that type of food, I might bring a bag of apples in the car. Mm. And I just worked my way through the bag of apples. So even with food that other people might regard as healthy, I still ate portions that were just not what normal eaters would eat.
Yeah. And can you tell us, what was it that it did for you, in the sense that, you know, What was it filling for you in the sense of, you know, we tend to eat because we need something filled. It's usually a kind of a hunger pain or something. Was there more?
I think at the time I just felt hungry. You know, I wouldn't have, if you asked me how I was, I would have said, I'm fine. There's not a bother in me. And it just felt hungry, and I felt hungry all the time. Now, looking back at this stage, I would have said, I'd say to you that I probably had fears about different things, maybe fears about how work had gone, fears about maybe something I'd be invited to, who was going to be there, who would I talk to, what would I wear. So a lot of fears about how will I cope, how will I be, even though the situations I'd be in were very normal and ordinary situations, you know, going to work, going to family events, meeting up with friends, things that, you know, one could say I shouldn't really have had fears about, but I would have. And when I ate, food was a drug for me. It just made me feel better. But calm at the time, I wouldn't have been conscious about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It clearly, like you say, it is medicating something in the sense that it's calming, it's getting rid of the anxiety, and yet at the same time, the actual experience at the kind of at the cold face, as it were, is one of just hunger. It's that's all it is.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I couldn't understand how I could still be hungry, because I would have had my meals. It wasn't that I was missing meals. And there would have been, you know, proper size meals, but the feeling was hunger.
So if the hunger was, you know, at least your perception, now I get that, you know, you very much now in retrospect would go, there was much more going on. But when somebody who was feeling that way, at what point does the penny drop and you go, I need a little bit of help with this? Do you kind of go to for help for your appetite, or what do you go looking for?
Well, my experience, Ronan, was that because of the volumes of food I was eating, I was concerned about my weight.
Sure.
So I went to a weight loss club to try and lose some weight. And what I found was that I couldn't stick with the plan. Stick with the plan. I might be able to do it for a little while, but I couldn't stick with it. So I was very concerned about my weight. And there were times where I could manage it, in inverted commas, in that I'd do a bit of exercise or I'd eat foods that were lower in calories. But I still was absolutely obsessed about food and obsessed about weight. So I used to just wonder how I could eat and be thin. You know, how could I just eat as much as I want and be thin?
Right.
And it's kind of impossible.
Yes, you know? Of course.
But that was the drive.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell us what the kind of result of that, you know, kind of phase was. What did it lead you to?
Eventually it led me to a place where I realised I'm absolutely beaten, that the measures that I used to try and control and enjoy my food and my weight just weren't working. So even though I hated putting on weight, that wasn't enough to stop me eating the way I was eating. And even though I hated that I was running out of clothes, that didn't stop me. And that really got my attention, because when I really, really tried to stop doing what I was doing, I found I couldn't. And it just brought me to a place where I realized this, whatever this is, I'd see it now as the disease of addiction, has me beaten. And it was out of that when I came across members of Addictive Eaters Anonymous, and I'd seen a flyer that said, is food a problem for you? And I used to think, yeah, it is, I made that first phone call.
So did the penny drop about the addiction before you went to Addictive Eaters, or was it around the same kind of time?
I realized I was beaten before started going to meetings, but when I did go to meetings then and just heard other people's stories and heard people describe what I have as the disease of addiction and mental obsession, physically being different to other people, that made sense. It seemed to fit my experience. So that all of that did happen roughly at the same time. Over the course of a couple of weeks.
So what was it like going to that first meeting? Was it intimidating? Was it weird? How did you find getting yourself through the door?
Yeah, I found it intense, I suppose, for my, when I say intense, because it was like letting the cat out of the bag, really admitting I have a problem that I can't manage myself. And I didn't, up until then, I really didn't want to admit that I had a problem I couldn't manage myself. So I had made a phone call to the fellowship, and I'd got to speak with a woman, and I knew from speaking with her that she just got it. And it was my first experience of really being honest about this, but also my first experience of realizing there's somebody else like me. And I had met another woman, and she had shared her story with me. So before I went to my first meeting, I'd actually had contact with two people, and it just made it a little bit easier. But yes, going in that first day to a meeting, I was hoping I wouldn't meet anyone I'd know, and I didn't. And yes, if I had, they would have been there for the same reason.
So, sure, I know.
But it was a relief to me to hear people share about what it had been like for them, and to just relate to them, and to find out that they happened to do what I was doing. They weren't obsessed about food, and they weren't obsessed about weight anymore. So it was a mixture of relief, and it was a mixture of hope, and just I kind of marveled at people's honesty, that you know, that they would share what it had been like for them, because I had spent so many years being so secretive about what I did, and here were people that were prepared to share their story with me so that I could feel just not alone.
Was there a feeling of relief around that then?
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us a bit about Addictive Eaters Anonymous. Is it like a kind of like an AA 12-step program, or is it something else?
Yeah, Ronan, it's very similar to AA. It's based on the 12 steps of recovery, and it's based on members just sharing their experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what's it like now, and what happened. And so when a person goes to a meeting, they'll hear stories about what it was like in addiction, what things they found helpful. And I suppose Addictive Eaters Anonymous, it's meetings, it's sponsorship, it's staying in touch with other members. There's different parts to it, but just mainly kind of, it's people.
And that kind of peer thing. So how has it been for you since? And how long has it been? Has it been a while?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years since I first joined the fellowship, and my experience has been just everything has changed. And when I say that, I'm just, you know, I've had experience of not having to be obsessed about food, not having to be obsessed about weight, being able to come and go from work without having to stop at a news agent's to get food, being able to be in the kitchen at home without having the food in the presses talking to me.
Absolutely. And that has finally diminished and gone, has it?
Yeah, my experience is just through coming to meetings, through sponsorship, and doing the 12 steps of Addictive Eaters Anonymous, I've just found that I've been relieved of the obsession to have to eat, to have to weigh myself, to have to be obsessed about my weight. So it's a program of recovery, and it's based on those 12 steps.
Wonderful. So before I let you go, where can people contact Addictive Eaters Anonymous, and are there online meetings, I suppose, given that we're in lockdown?
Yeah, Ronan, we normally in Ireland would have had one face-to-face meeting a week, but now we're on online meetings. So there are 8 online meetings a week across the world. And if a person goes on to our website, and that's www.aeairl.org or www.addictiveeatersanonymous.org,
okay,
You'll find links to those online meetings.
Brilliant.
Likewise, we have a phone number, and we'd be delighted to hear from you if you'd like to make contact with us. A member would return your phone call and arrange to meet you post-COVID or sure. to talk with you on the phone. So that Lovely. Phone number for Ireland is 01-554-9725. Or likewise, people can send us an email at contact@aeairl.org.
Lovely. Lovely speaking to you. Not going to mention your name, but thank you. Anonymous member from Addictive Eaters Anonymous, AEA. Thank you so much for talking to us today. God bless
you. Thank you very much, Roland.
Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Spirit. Now, organisers of the National Ploughing Championships have confirmed that this year's event that was due to take place this September has been cancelled. This will be a substantial financial blow to farmers and exhibitors around the country. And on the line to tell us more and to speak to us about the impact the coronavirus is having on the farming industry in Ireland, we have Hannah Quinn Mulligan, news correspondent with the Irish Farmers Journal. You're very welcome to the show, Hannah. How are you?
Thanks for having me. Not too bad at all. It's a lovely day, at least.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's funny. I was just saying earlier on, you know, it is like when you're out in the sun, it's fabulous. And then you get into the shade and it's like, oh, it's a little bit cold still. But, you know, I'm taking it where I can find it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Listen, first of all, Hannah, can you give us an update on the factors that went into deciding to cancel this year's Ploughing Championships in September?
Oh, well, I suppose, like anything, the McHugh family, Anna May and Anna Marie, were very concerned about people's safety and people's health, and that was their primary concern. So while the actual ploughing itself, the ploughing championships, can go ahead, you know, furrows can still be ploughed, it will be on a much smaller scale, and the event that everyone associates with the ploughing won't be happening. Now, as you can imagine, this is a huge blow to, say, the community of Carlow and to the wider farming community who look forward to it every year. I mean, it's estimated that the ploughing is worth about €35 million to the economy every
Amazing.
Year. So it is an absolutely huge blow.
And, you know, how big an event is this? You know, I haven't been down to it, and you know, I kind of, anybody I know, I'm from a farming community, and I'm probably the only person in the village that hasn't been. But it's like our village stops basically when
yeah, I was going to say it's scandalous that you haven't been. It's a big community right. event, and yeah. even if you haven't been to it, people come back
it's
from it, and
massive.
Everyone kind of talks about who
sure,
they've seen or what they've seen.
The school's empty, you know, that kind of way. Enormous numbers.
Huge numbers. I mean, we're talking hundreds of thousands. So visitor attendance last year was 297,000.
Yeah,
there were 1,700 exhibitors, and you know, people, you know, infamously, I suppose, people collect loads of free pens and post it
exactly,
and
yeah,
Twitter
yeah.
and everything like that. But it does have a much more serious role in as well, and that it's something. Last year, in particular, the weather was fabulous, and it was just such a well-deserved break for farmers when you take into account what they'd gone through in terms of kind of the year before with kind of droughts and money worries, and then you had the beast from the east and everything like that, and the ploughing the year before, obviously there was Storm Alley, and
that's right, yes,
there was a massive knock-on effect to the finances of the ploughing as well. So last year it seemed like everything came together. Everyone was delighted with the location, even people were even happy with traffic control, you know, it seemed yeah. like it was everything had just aligned perfectly, so I think people were as well really looking forward to the ploughing this year again, but unfortunately it's not going to go ahead, and that is probably the right decision.
So what, you know, talking kind of specifically about, you know, just the coronavirus crisis, not just the ploughing obviously, but corona generally, what is it having on the farming industry around the country?
Well, people will probably be aware of one big thing in that the restaurants are closed, even the fast food outlets are closed, and not just in Ireland, but across Europe. And if you think of the meat that was supplied to those restaurants, or even, you know, eggs or milk or anything like that, you know, it takes a knock-on effect on the primary producer there. And we can see that was reflected in meat prices for a long time. And even Meat Industry Ireland are saying that throughput is back in factories by about 20% compared
Gosh,
to normal.
Yeah.
So that's a huge impact then on farmers if the same demand isn't there from factories, because we are an exporting nation. You know, about 90% of the food we produce is exported. So that has to be taken into account. And then not only then do you have the financial impact on farmers, but I think you really need to look on the social impact as well. So with the closure of the marts, and that might have been, you know, one of the main outlets for a lot of farmers.
In terms of meeting each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
in terms of just socializing or even having a hot meal. You know, the kind of the idea of the old bachelor farmer, you getting out and about or that kind of thing. You know, that has had a huge impact on the farm community as well. And some marts are still operating on a very limited capacity, but I mean, we're talking about, you know, maybe kind of around 20% of the capacity that they would usually run at for some marts. So, and obviously there's very, very strict social distancing guidelines so that it's more of a drop-off and pick-up service. It's not that same interaction that used to go on in March.
And did I hear that there was some issue around the virus in some meat processing places?
Yeah, that's right. So it's been confirmed by the Department of Health that there are now 10 clusters in meat factories across the country. And we know of some specific problems. So recently, Dawn Kilbeggan closed temporarily because of factory workers there testing positive for the virus. And we know that the HSE have tested a lot of workers. They've tested all the workers in Ross Dara meat plant in Ross Grey. And then we're hearing the Irish Farmers Journal as well understands that Keepack and a number of Keepack factories, their workers have been tested by the HSE as well. So
I was just wondering, like, is it even possible to socially distance in some ways in certain, you know, meat processing and abattoirs? You know, I was just thinking about if you have two people carrying a carcass, for instance, I understand you could put it onto a piece of machinery.
That's a good example. I think what Meat Industry Ireland is saying that they have followed all the HSE guidelines and protocols, and that they have a COVID-19 response team in every single meat plant as well.
Okay.
But we do know that the HSE are kind of investigating instances in meat plants and that they are concerned about it. And if you look across the border, there's an awful lot of concern about it, and the death of one employee who contracted COVID-19 been reported in Moy Park poultry plant as well, and there's lots of concerns in other meat processing plants in Northern Ireland. So that's a huge concern, and the union, or the Workers Union Unite, have written to the First Minister and Deputy First Minister calling for the temporary closure of meat factories there for testing to be carried out. So I guess in the back of everyone's minds, maybe we're looking across at the US and seeing the huge issue around COVID-19 and factory workers in the US. No one wants that situation.
No, absolutely not. Though in fairness, you know, it seems like the later that people started to put these things in place, the more disastrous it was. And we did get there at least reasonably early. I know people say we could have gone earlier again, but at least we did something. Can I just ask you a question? Look, forgive me now for being so stupid here, but you know, I'm thinking about things like milk, you know, like presumably cows can't stop producing milk. What happens to all the excess milk if milk can't be sold?
So we did hear reports in the UK of farmers milk dumping. So a lot of the milk in England, say, a number of farms would produce milk just for kind of cafes. I mean, we're thinking about Costa, we're talking about Fresh, you know, those kind of big chain, Starbucks, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the milk in Ireland isn't quite tied up to the same manufacturing processes. So far we haven't heard any reports of milk dumping in Ireland, but what farmers will be aware of is that the price of milk has gone down, and also a lot of the processors. So if we're looking at Glanbia, looking at Dairy Gold, looking at Kerry, the price has gone down by nearly 2 cents per litre. So a lot of the farmers will be concerned that, you know, the impact of the pandemic on global milk prices is impacting the price nationally. And going forward, when we think about dairy expansion recently, a lot of farmers have loans. I know a lot of people have mortgages as well, but if you just think about trying to make your loan repayments, you're usually factoring in a certain price per litre that you're getting every month. So there are a lot of concerned dairy farmers out there about the price of milk.
So finally, Hannah, are there concerns about the long-lasting impact here?
Yeah, for every sector, I think there are massive concerns. I think there's some concerns that the mart trade might not recover fully in some places, especially in the west of Ireland, if we're talking about smaller marts who kind of need a turnover like any business, just to keep their business going. And so there's going to be huge impact. I mean, the Irish Farmers Journal, we came out with a UCD study last week, and it says that the impact might be up to 600 million euro for the farm community just for 1 year, you know, and that's the best case, one of the better case scenarios. So yeah, for in general, I think we're all aware it's going to have a massive impact, but on farming, definitely we'll be living with this for a long time.
Okay. Hannah Quinn Mulligan, news correspondent with the Irish Farmers Journal. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. Get to the ploughing.
Yeah, I certainly will. Bye now.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.